Mike Leonard, it's good to see you as always. How are you?
Great to see you, John. Happy to be here on a nice fall day.
You do a lot of federal defense work. You represent whistleblowers, too. Are you in the middle of trials, preparing for others, kind of just seeing which way the wind blows these days?
We're kind of in between, everything at once. We have, I'd say, 5 or 6 trials coming up in the next 6 months, so that's going to be a fun challenge, mostly in federal court. This week was rather interesting, unusual for us. We had probably 2 full days of settlement conferences, meaning in our civil practice where we represent individuals such as whistleblowers and sometimes people who are bringing on a plaintiff side discrimination cases. We had settlement conferences which took hours where you're trying to get your case resolved. So in one instance, we had a judge from the same building we're in who's not assigned to the case serve as the settlement conference mediator. Another one, which is very typical, you have the parties hire a private mediator, and you spend the whole day trying to get to a settlement and get paid, John. So it's painful, but we got there in both cases.
Do you find that work more interesting, just different than the trials, or more tedious?
Well, I mean, the civil cases we have often get to trial. So what I really like is getting to trial all types of cases. You know, obviously 75% of them are criminal. But we also get these civil cases at trial. But when they settle, sometimes that's a great result for your client because on the civil world, unfortunately, something like some crazy figure of 90 to 95% of cases get resolved before trial, either because they get dismissed or because they settle. So it's a common thing to happen, and oftentimes it's very much in your client's interest to get paid and not have any risk at trial. But, of course, from our standpoint, we like to go to trial, so sometimes we're okay when they don't settle.
Well, you and Stephen were just kind of talking a little peel behind the curtain about lawyer talk or not gamesmanship, but one-upmanship about, are you a litigator? Are you a trial attorney? Do you actually go to trial? Is that like a friction point between lawyers?
It can be. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people who say they're trial lawyers who really never try cases or extremely rarely try cases or look to get out of ways to try cases, and there's other people who just really love it and do it all the time.
And there's got to be some fields, though, that lend themselves to people not often going to trial versus going to trial, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certain areas of the law, that's just not going to happen. You're rarely, if ever, going to get to trial, or it might be an area of the law you just don't go to trial because that's not part of what you do. But these days, the most common types of cases to go to trial, of course, would be criminal, number one, because, again, you only have 2 options. You either go to trial or you plead guilty. So the stakes are often very high. The sentencing consequences very high. Makes it more likely they're going to go. And also the volume of criminal cases compared to anything else is astronomical. And then personal injury cases, of course, they often go to trial as well. And employment cases, surprisingly, in terms of the genre of cases go to trial, happens on a regular basis as well. And so do civil rights cases involving, you know, people falsely arrested, falsely detained. So I think those buckets are probably the ones that most likely go to trial. There's a whole bunch of others that go to trial on a regular basis, but yeah, it's fun. There is a little friction sometimes that, you know, not me, John, but sometimes people who try cases might be like, oh, he's not a trial lawyer. He's a litigator. He never takes a case to trial. You know, who cares? I mean, ultimately, it's kind of what you enjoy and what's up your alley. And sometimes it's not in your client's interest to go to trial, quite frankly.
Right. No, and that makes sense. I do always appreciate, though, that when a law firm says, look, we'll try and settle. We'll try and get the best case to save money, to save time, to save energy, if we can find an equitable solution here. But I like lawyers that do follow it up with, but we'll go to, hey, we're going to trial if we need to, you know?
Well, everybody says that. That's the funny thing.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's really funny, especially in civil cases, you know. So, you know, we're the ones in the civil cases, typically we'd be filing the lawsuit, you know, representing a whistleblower, sometimes defending, you know, but you know, we'll get the pushback from their side. Hey, we're going to try this, and we're like, great, we would love that.
We'd love that, yeah.
And you know, we know that that's super unlikely because on the defense side, you know, you're getting a lot of pressure from your client to settle the case because it's an economic decision, right?
Yeah.
And also a resource decision. Do they really want to spend all these hours, you know, not only paying their attorneys by the hour, but having all their employees sit for depositions and
emotions,
go to court hearings, go to trial,
yeah,
the adverse consequences of publicity associated with trial. So, you know, there's unique challenges on the defense side, unique pressures that make it difficult to get the case to trial.
The biggest case out there right now is the start of the Michael Madigan trial. Long anticipated, been on many winding roads and journeys, and it would take forever to explain all of it. But we can give a broad overview of the case. But more importantly, what I wanted to do was talk a little bit about the jury selection, because that's where we are in this case. And we have a wide pool of jurors that the both sides are going to and have already started kind of grilling the jurors on both sides. Have you been following it and seeing what's happening there?
I have, yeah. So you've had basically, I think, 3 or 4 full days of jury selection. The approach taken by the judge in the case, Judge Blakey, who's the federal court judge assigned to the case, great judge. I think he's really taken a great approach in that he's given the sides really free rein to question the potential jurors.
What do you mean?
Well, it's unusual. In federal court, unfortunately, typically you get, I would say, quite a limited time period to question jurors. You know, a lot of the judges take the position that, you know, a lot of the things that you would want to delve into as a lawyer, they're not going to let you go there. They're going to limit you to a lot of things that they think is relevant, you know, in terms of a person's occupation, person's family circumstances, a person's whether they have any involvement with law enforcement, whether they have any, interests that relate to the case directly, you know. So
those seem like the basics. Why would you need to know more than that?
Well, you always need to know more, John. You know, just look at it this way. If you met somebody at a party or you really wanted to get to know them and get a real sense of who they are, of course, name, rank, and serial number would not be enough for you. And when your client is on trial in federal court for serious charges, you want to know enough about them as you can, as much as you can. You also want to attempt to form some sort of rapport with those potential jurors, even if they're not ones that you choose to select. The other side may select them. And so you're going to want to get as much information as you can. And what Judge Blakey is doing, he's really giving them a lot of room to really delve deep into their biases, their beliefs, their interests, what they know about the political system, what they know about Madigan, what they know about politics, what news feeds they're getting, all which are important to get a good sense of who these people are. And I think that should happen more often in cases. But let's face it, you know, every case doesn't have the length that this case is going to be. It's going to be a 10 or 11 week case. Obviously, it's important, but, you know, a lot of other cases are important, too. But I think it's a great approach that they're handling. And then we can talk about some of the stuff we've seen so far.
Well, I wanted to ask you more about this jury thing, because it seems that you want to make sure you get as much information about people. One, to see if maybe they'd be a great juror for you or a bad juror for you. And I can understand that. You want to see that. One thing that you struck there was that you want to interact with them regardless to develop a rapport for them. I imagine there's a sense of, at the very least, no matter what, you don't want a single juror who is put in that jury box as the defense attorney. You don't want anyone in that jury box that knew that you absolutely did not want them for whatever reason, because you don't want a juror that has a chip on their shoulder saying, the defense didn't want me here and I'm here anyways.
Oh, exactly. And let's face it, so there's some parameters here. So number one, you know, each defendant's counsel is going to get what are called peremptory challenge. So they're typically going to get 10, meaning that I can get rid of 10 people without giving any explanation to the court. I don't have to say why. However, I can't strike those people for discriminatory reasons. I couldn't do it on a race-based factor or something like that. However, I do get unlimited challenges for cause, meaning if I can show that by their answers, the potential juror has shown that they cannot be fair and impartial, that they have some bias or prejudice that would influence their ability to fare, I move to strike them for cause.
And you argue it with the judge.
And you argue it outside the presence of those potential jurors.
That's what I was going to say. They don't see that part.
No, absolutely not. And the other side often will oppose you because they know you want to get the person off. They know you believe they're going to be good for their side. They're opposing you. And the judge has to make the call. Because if the judge doesn't get rid of that person, I have to use one of my peremptory challenges, one of my cherished 10, right? So if I want to get rid of somebody, I want to come up with a basis for cause, but that's often difficult because they might not have actually said something that would show the court that they can't be fair and impartial. And also, I think you and I have touched upon this in other settings, but the judge sometimes does, you know, what we might call rehabilitation. So let's say John Hansen is in the jury pool, mm-hmm. and John Hansen says to the judge, oh, judge, I can't be fair.
Which a lot of they're like, I don't want to do this jury. I got my life to lead. I'm just going to say, nope, I can't be fair. Okay, that is something I might say.
Well, a lot of people
I got a lot of jobs, Mike. I can't take off all four of them.
You are a busy guy, Mr. Anson.
Yeah, I can't be on this jury, so I can't be fair.
But a lot of people try that technique because they've heard from others, hey, just persist in saying you can't be fair.
All right, well, let's play it out. What would a judge say to me?
So John Hanson says to the court, I'm going to ask you.
All right, go ahead.
Mr. Hanson, is there anything that about this case what you've heard from us so far, which has been very limited, that you think would make you unable to be fair and impartial to my client?
Look, I just assume if someone's here, they did something wrong. I can't be fair, and you know, I can't see through that.
Okay, so what I would do as the attorney is I would try to work with that. I would try to say that I understand, and I would say that that's a common thing where people might have the idea that because a client's sitting here on trial, they might have done something wrong. However, and I try to, you know, talk to them about our system and the presumption of innocence and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're hell-bent on getting off the jury, or maybe you honestly believe it, you're still going to say to me, persist and say, oh, I can't be fair. And so that may be enough to get you challenged for cause. However, there's oftentimes the intervention of the judge who'll say, Mr. Hanson,
yes, sir.
Are you telling me that if I instruct you on what the law is and how you're supposed to decide this case, you can't follow my instructions?
Oh, well, Your Honor, I'd obviously follow your instructions.
Yeah, and I know you've talked about, Mr. Hanson, during selection about a certain incident you had and some involvement with the judicial system several years ago in your own case.
Yeah.
But you understand, Mr. Hanson, the case has nothing to do with why we're here today.
Of course, it's something completely different.
And of course, I assume, Mr. Hanson, you'd be able to put that aside, wouldn't you, if you were selecting a jury and decide this case based upon the facts and circumstances presented?
Yeah, I could see myself doing that.
Yeah. So the problem for us as lawyers is oftentimes
I see.
The judge will aggressively or somewhat aggressively rehabilitate the juror and get them to, and you know, it's not an intentional thing. They're not trying to get biased jurors, but they'll get answers which, in my view, are sort of expected. You know, no one wants to tell the authority figure, a judge, that they can't be fair and they'll refuse to follow their direction. So a lot of times you'll get compliant answers, and then we'll sometimes get a chance to come back and try to spin them again and try to get them to really expose themselves, because I want to develop a record that when I get to argue before the court, I'll say, Judge, I know the individual gave compliant answers to you, but when I got the chance to ask him questions after you, here's what they said, and therefore we think there's a reason to strike them for cause. So it's this battle that goes back and forth. But I think one of the interesting things you touched upon is this idea that, you know, Madigan, who's a, you know, extraordinarily well-known figure in Illinois, the most powerful guy in politics for decades, and some of these jurors, and I think some of them are being truthful, potential jurors, like they had no idea who he was.
No idea.
Knew nothing about his case, knew nothing about the allegations, which is, you know, good in a lot of ways, because then you get a blank slate, perhaps. But, you know, it's funny, we have these preconceived notion that everyone's going to know about the Madigan case. Everyone's going to have read about it. You know, we need to question them for hours. But a lot of times these people come there and have little knowledge of what's really going on out there.
I'm so jealous. I want to live in a world where I didn't know anything about the Michael Madigan case or anything on those lines. We got a question. Let's go to Karen. Karen's got an interesting one. Hey, Karen, you're on WGN.
Hi. You know, I have always wished to serve on a jury, but I don't know how to answer questions to get on that jury. I mean, if you can just...
So you are the opposite. You want to be on the jury, and you want to know how to answer questions to get on it.
Yeah, I think I could be partial in the whole thing, but then I think that if I answered that way, they would be like, oh, brother, we don't want this one.
let's find out. What do you think, Mike? What are questions that... Is there any way to, like, coach yourself to get on the jury, or can people see right through that, too?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things I would say is that sometimes you get people who seem extremely over-eager to get on,
yes,
which also sometimes cause me pause, but you want to ask them a lot of questions to try to get in your own head why they want to be on. And from my standpoint, if the answers I'm getting suggest to me it's a positive reason for my client that they want to get on, then by all means, I want them on the jury. Other times, I'm highly suspicious, and it might be I have a belief based upon my questions of them that the reason they want to get on is not good for my side. But in general, you know, the caller makes a good point. As long as you can legitimately be fair and impartial and look, decide the case upon the facts presented in court and not on some preconceived notion or bias or something you've already read about, you're going to, of course, have a good chance of getting on. The problem you're going to come, you know, confront is that the attorneys have their own biases, their own preconceptions of what they think is a good juror for them. So you may be completely open to the process, and you may be completely honest in your answers that, yeah, you can be fair and impartial. You can decide the case on the facts presented in court. You can follow the judge's instructions, which is all the things that the lawyers and the judge want to hear, but it doesn't mean that one of the attorneys might try to strike you.
Interesting.
Because whatever reason in their head, they don't think that you're as favorable to their side as they want you to be. Other lawyers are going to say, look, this is perfect. This person, I believe them. I think they're being truthful. I think they can be fair. So, that's what I want. I want someone who can actually give my client a shot and who's not so pro-law enforcement or so pro-government that I don't have a chance.
But so basically, be yourself. Answer the questions truthfully. Don't go into long paragraphs of trying to get on or trying to get off. Be yourself. And then you never know what the lawyer's going to react to, and it's out of your hands usually.
Yeah, I mean, if you're honestly open to the process, meaning that you're honestly open to just trying the case on the facts that are presented in court and following what the judge says, then yeah, by all means, you got a great chance of getting on, subject to some attorney thinking that you are good or not good for their case.
Karen, good luck, okay? Have a good one, all right?
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Got Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers here with me. He's a federal defense attorney. And Mike, we could probably do entire shows on Netflix documentaries about true crime cases. You and I were just talking about the Eric and Lyle Menendez case. You couldn't even find the docudrama on Netflix, but you stumbled on another documentary that you enjoyed, and then we went into how to make a murder, all these sorts of cases. They really are interesting.
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but the Eric and Lyle Menendez case was a case that was tried in California in the early 90s, like maybe 1993, and it was covered internationally, and it was on court TV. It was like one of the first cases ever televised at trial, so people could actually watch the whole thing. And the defense in the case by the young men was that they killed their parents because they claimed they were being sexually abused. And at that time, in the early 90s, that was sort of an unheard of thing to even talk about, certainly as a defense at a trial. And so now a new generation of people are looking at the case because they have access to it online, on TikTok, on YouTube, etc. And it's created this huge groundswell in support of the two convicted defendants that, you know, they weren't given a fair chance, that people didn't believe their claims of sexual abuse because at that time period in life in the world, people weren't willing to do that. And as you pointed out, apparently that's the case is now being looked at by the prosecutor's office in California again, because apparently, according to you, at least there's other people coming forward with similar allegations of abuse by the father.
Yes. So. And that they've been out there actually for some time, just no one covered it. So,
but it's a great issue where we are as a society and what's happening publicly, how that can impact a trial.
Right. And they even admitted they killed their parents.
Yes.
And of course you go to jail for that. But are there mitigating circumstances that don't send you to life for prison? I don't know. That's up to a jury to decide, as long as they're allowed to present the facts as they are. The trial was probably the mid-90s by the time they actually got to trial, early to mid-90s. That's a lot different now.
Yeah, I think it was 1993. Yeah, in that case at the time, there was a lesser offense that could have been found guilty of. So the self-defense, a pure self-defense, didn't apply because they weren't in imminent danger of being killed by their parents. But their theory as presented to the jury was they were subject to all this abuse and that their parents were, according to them, you know, preparing to take action against them to kill them. They believed because one of them had confronted the father recently about the sexual abuse. So in any event, there was something lesser they could have been convicted of, and now there would be something that would be even more favorable to them. But it's just an interesting case. It always shows that where we are as a society, what's going on publicly can have a huge impact upon the jury that tries your case and what they're willing to believe, what they're willing to accept.
I'm not, I'll just sum it up like this. I want to get to Tisa's call, but I'm not losing sleep over the fact that they're in prison. Like, some documentaries make you feel like, oh my goodness, there's been this huge injustice. But I do feel a fresh look at what happened in the mitigating circumstances, even if it doesn't change their case, could maybe at least provide some guidance for future cases and situations like that.
You probably wouldn't even support Ferris Bueller when they were putting up the free Ferris signs. You probably were against him too, John.
Absolutely.
You're the juror we don't want as a defense team.
You are. Unlike my friend Jeff, and we played his interview a couple weeks ago, one week, and that was interesting. I'll tee that up a little bit later. But let's get to Tisa. Tisa was held on through the news. First of all, I love the name Tisa. How are you today?
Tricia. I get that a lot, so I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I am calling because I've been called for jury duty before, but I've had little kids and I've homeschooled, so they've always let me go and said, yep, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, now that I'm past that stage, if I'm called to be on a jury, what can I expect for payment as far as federal, local? And, you know, you also hear about them putting people up in hotels for this high-priority case, or, like, they can't even go out and eat in public or talk to their family about the case. So
right.
What could someone expect being on a jury like that?
That's a great question. Let's start with the sequestering. That is very rare, right, Mike?
Yeah, so even in a case like Madigan, they won't be sequestered. I mean, sequestration occurs rarely. So, for example, the O.J. Simpson trial, sequestered because the insane amount of publicity surrounding the case, the fact that people might be following jurors, all that sort of stuff, the fact that they wanted to be anonymous. You know, sometimes it happens in a huge, you know, drug lord type of conspiracy case or a mafia case, but sequestration is definitely rare and rarely happens. It's not happening in the Madigan case, so you wouldn't have to worry about that. What one reality is, though, you're paid little to nothing. So it doesn't matter what type of case it is. It doesn't matter how long the trial is going to take. It doesn't matter if it's going to take 4 to 10 weeks out of your life. And like the Madigan case is going to be tried over like 10 to 12 week period. They're not getting any more money because
of that. Well, they're getting more daily pay.
Well, they're getting paid each day,
right?
Which is not really nominal. So,
how much is it?
I think it's like $40-$50 or something like that. So, I mean, so some people in that district, they're traveling from an hour and a half away. So, you know, it's not even probably going to cover your parking or your transportation.
They don't
costs.
Cover your parking?
It's probably that daily fee is probably not going to cover your parking. So
that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, but Tisha, we hope you're on future juries. I mean. You're going to lean towards the defense in the criminal cases, we hope?
Tisa, you're leaning towards the defense or no?
You know, it just depends. I think I'm like the last caller. I think I can be pretty fair either way.
Good. That's what Mike likes to hear.
That's what we want. That's what we want. Someone who's willing to give the client a fair shake.
And you have a unique name, so Mike will remember Tisa. So, although, of course, we should never suggest any improprietary, anything along those lines. Tisa, thanks for the phone call. It was a good one.
Tisa. Appreciate it.
Should we pay jurors more? Would that help create a system in which people are more willing and less likely to go, I'm not going to show up, or I'm going to try and get off this thing?
Well, I mean, I think the fair thing would be to at least pay them for, like, parking, transportation, meal, right? Of course, that should be done. It should be uniform. Paying them more, probably not, but just enough to cover those out-of-pockets. You know, the law also is, look, you cannot get fired for serving on a jury, but it puts people under intense pressure, like because, you know, of course you can't get fired under the law, but, you know, for that 1 week or 2 week or 10 weeks you're on trial, your job's not going away. So you're stressed about it. You're going to be stressed about during breaks. You're going to be stressed about it at night. It creates a huge burden upon people. So it's not easy to do.
Oh, they'd find a backup
for
post.
Extended time.
They'd find a backup post for me and I'd never have the job again. There's way more qualified people out there to do what I'm doing.
To do this job?
To do, yes.
So John, I'm not going to.
They'd have a fill-in when I was at jury duty, and then I'd come back. They're like, you know what, actually.
the old Lou Gehrig.
Lou Gehrig,
Lou
yeah.
Gehrig going in for Wally Pipp. John,
I'm the Wally Pipp.
John, you're not replaceable. Come on. There's going to be a huge text. You know, there's going to be lots of text saying, John, we can't replace you. Don't go.
No, that's why I never take a day off, because I'm always afraid of being Wally Pipped.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, you've got a long legacy. You're the one that gets the not guilty verdicts many times more than the average Joe. So
we try. Yeah. We definitely try.
Okay, so just really quickly, the Madigan thing you mentioned now a couple weeks. We'll obviously probably have more time to talk about it as this thing progresses. But jury selection looks like it'll go the rest into this next week, and then opening statements not for till the following week.
Yeah, because I think they're getting close. They've got 11 chosen, but you have to have 12, which what the 12 will deliberate. But there's going to be 6 alternates. And typically, in a case, you usually have like 2 alternates. But this case, going 10, 11 weeks, there is a high probability you're going to lose 1, 2. You could lose more. 6 is pretty rare to have the 6 alternates. The thing that really sucks, can I say sucks
well,
on the air here?
Well, you already did twice, so
okay.
Stinks
right.
Would be preferred.
I have such a bad mouth, John, for radio. But in any event, what's horrible is that the jurors aren't told who the alternates are.
So, what do you mean?
Well, so you'll have 18 people in the jury box, right? They'll listen to the whole trial. They'll hear closing arguments. And then all of a sudden, the judge will say, okay, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Jones, Ms. Peabody, et cetera, can you stay back for a moment? And the other jurors will go to the room to deliberate, and he'll tell them, for finally, hey guys, thank you for your service. You are the alternate, so you will not be deliberating. However, we can't have you talk to anyone about the case. If something were to occur where a juror would have to leave, one of you might be called back. One or more of you might be called back, so you can't discuss the case with anybody. Thank you for your service, you know.
Do you go home then, or do you still sit while they're deliberating?
No,
you sit in the room.
You go home, baby. You can't be in the room. So imagine that, sitting through a 10, 12-week trial and then learning at the end that you don't get to deliberate. That would be harsh.
Is that just unique to this federal court?
No, it's everywhere. So, I mean, you can't have
What about state courts, though? They do it differently, right?
No. I mean, you're never, you know, sometimes people can figure out if they're the alternates, but...
How?
Because, I mean, some systems are such that, you know, the first 12 chosen are going to be the 12 on the jury.
Oh, so if you're 13 and 14.
Yeah, so, but sometimes people just don't know. So you could spend all that time and be all excited, you know, putting your hand, clasping your hands together, getting ready to go deliberate, and sorry, you're out, buddy.
I would imagine, though, that makes sense, because you would not want someone who thinks they're an alternate that will never be called upon to drift in attention span because they think this will never apply to me.
Correct. You know, you sometimes have problems with jurors, shall we say, falling asleep once in a while or not paying attention too much. But yeah, if you told people in advance, look, you're not going to be deliberating unless someone, you know, can't serve. I mean, I think obviously the result would be they wouldn't be paying as close attention as they might otherwise be.
Do they should have, if there's like six alternate jurors, they should be jury number two. And I'd be like, how about we deliberate, us six?
It would be kind of fun.
And see what happened if we came to the same result.
Yeah, it'd be kind of fun if they could do that. Yeah, but they just can't have any part of the process if they're not the 12 deliberators.
The B jury, if you will. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Okay, so 10 to 12 weeks is what this is looking at. We'll have the opening statements, and it'll be a real slog because it's going to be a lot of, tapes being played, a lot of... mumbo jumbo, and ultimately this is a matter of, can the defense prove that this is politics as normal, or can the prosecutors prove, no, this is part of a giant scheme that has been perpetrated by Madigan and his co-defendant?
Yeah, and practically, you know, are the jurors convinced that there's really a connection between legislative activity taken by Madigan and all these efforts to curry favor with him, influence him, etc.? So it's going to be a great battle. As I said, John, I'm predicted a not guilty for Mr. Madigan. So we'll see. We might have to play this tape back in 12 weeks and see if I was right or wrong, John.
224 says, John, is this the lawyer who handles whistleblower cases? I have to leave really quick. Didn't catch the name. It's Michael Leonard. And what is the number, Michael Leonard?
312-380-6559, John.
6559. 312-380-6559. I'm texting that right to you, 224. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Already getting questions for Stephen A. Leahy, which means, Mike, I got to give you the boot, my friend.
Wow. So tough. You know, I do all this service for you, John, and just kicked off, you know.
Kicked off the show.
Challenge for cause.
We'll talk soon, I'm sure, my friend.
Take care, buddy. Appreciate it.
Great, Mike Leonard. And we'll catch up at the end of watching the Eric and Lyle Menendez case and documentary.